Thank you. All right, so I guess I'll start with an apology. I was hoping to make content specifically for you. I got a little bit too sidetracked with the wildfires in California to make something new for you. So the request was make something with lots of math about open problems in GANs. I'm actually gonna give you an overview of exciting frontiers in adversarial machine learning research, and there won't really be much math. It's more of the pretty pictures, general audience type talk. Okay, so after the apology, the next thing is, let's talk about the format a little bit. Everything I'm gonna show you is on the internet, so anything I'm gonna say that's in my slides, you can already see two or three videos of me saying on the internet. What that means is it's not super important that I get through all my slides. If there's anything that interests you, wave your arms and interrupt and we'll talk about that. And I don't care how long of a tangent we go on. And if somebody in the audience is frustrated with the tangent being too long, you can just see the video of what I would have said if the tangent hadn't happened. So nobody should feel bad about pulling me onto a tangent that's relevant to your interests. Okay, so that's it for disclaimers about the format. The topic of the talk is going to be adversarial machine learning. What I mean by adversarial machine learning is that there's more than one player, more than one cost. In most machine learning algorithms so far, we can describe everything as an optimization algorithm. We have a model that we want to make predictions. We have some sort of cost function measuring how bad those predictions are, and we adjust the parameters to make the predictions become less and less bad over time. We can illustrate that with this cost function graph on the left side of the slide. There, the goal is to find a minimum of the cost function to find a model that makes the best predictions. But that doesn't describe every scenario that we might be interested in. A lot of the time, we might actually have more than one, what I'll call a player, involved in this scenario, where each player has different objectives. In the simplest case, one player is trying to maximize the cost function while the other player is trying to minimize it. And we can actually represent this as a saddle point in a graph. So if we suppose that one player can control this axis and another player can control this axis, the maximizing player is trying to find a point that's a local maximum on their cross section, and the minimizing player is trying to find a point that's a local minimum on their cross section. And then when you combine these two cross sections, you get this point called a saddle point. In general, you might imagine that there are costs that aren't just negation from each other. That would take more than one graph to show. But everything that I'm going to describe today is about this idea of what happens when you have different agents learning at the same time and their interests compete. Sometimes that'll be because there are really different entities in the real world, like a person sending spam and a person building a spam detector. Other times it'll be fictional entities in a fictional competition that we've contrived for other purposes. The state of machine learning research today is really exciting. It's gone through what I call a Cambrian explosion of research topics. Until a few years ago, there was really only one research topic in machine learning, and that was how do we make machine learning work? A few years ago, machine learning started to work for some things, and now we can actually explore in different directions. Some of the directions we can explore are taking things that don't really work yet and making them work better. So one of those topics is generative modeling, where so far machine learning has mostly been good in terms of classification and regression, but now we're starting to be able to make it generate data rather than just label data with output values. We might also be interested in giving some new properties to machine learning that it didn't have before. So for example, machine learning right now is not secure at all. If an attacker wants to interfere with its operation and make it produce bad predictions that cause your overall system to have bad behaviors, it's very easy for an attacker to do that. So we might be interested in adding this new property of having some security guarantees to machine learning algorithms. I'll go through each of these different new topics in our Cambrian explosion of research, and I'll tell you how adversarial machine learning is an interesting part of the frontier of each of the topics that I've chosen. So the first of them is generative modeling, and it's the thing that I'm personally probably best known for. The idea of generative modeling is that we would like to make a model that can train on a bunch of data and then can make more data that comes from the same distribution. Or another variant of it is you can make a model that estimates the probability of a specific input point later on. So this here is a data set called the Celeb A training data set. It consists of high resolution photos of different real world celebrities. After training a generative model on this data set, it was able to produce images like these. These are images of people who have never existed before, but look like they could plausibly come from the distribution of people who become celebrities in our society. And the resolution of these images is quite high. I actually had to downscale them to fit them on the slide. So this is basically what the goal of generative modeling is. How does it actually work? One of the approaches today that's popular is called generative adversarial networks. And this is the thing that I'm known for, where the idea is we actually contrive a conflict between two different networks and force their performance in this game to cause them to learn to generate realistic data. So there are two different players in this game. The first one is what we call the discriminator network. And the discriminator network is really just a differentiable function that we'll call D that has some learnable parameters. We use this function to implement a binary classifier. So usually you've seen binary classifiers for other tasks, like looking at an image and telling you whether it's a cat or a dog, or you know, looking at some measurements from a patient and saying whether they're sick or healthy, or saying what disease they have. Here we're going to use this classifier to say whether the input data is real or fake. So about half the time we're going to train the model on images that come from a real training set. We're going to run the model and we're going to tell it that it should say that they're real. So it should try to output a value near one, indicating that the probability of the input being real rather than fake is high. The other half of the time, we'll show it data that's fake. We don't need to describe quite yet where the fake data comes from. When we show it the fake data, we want this binary classifier to output a value near zero to say that the probability of it being real is very low. So that's one of the players in the game. And if you've worked on machine learning before, it should be very familiar. It's really just a binary classifier. The point where things start to be a little bit different is when we bring in the other player. The other player is where the fake data actually comes from. So the other player is a model that we call the generator. It's a function that we represent with the letter G. And it creates this fake data by starting with random noise and transforming it with this differentiable function to produce outputs that it intends to be interpretable as real valid data. If you're familiar with random number generation algorithms, quite a lot of random number generation algorithms work in this way. Like if you want to generate samples from a Gaussian distribution with some covariance matrix, you can start with independent Gaussian noise and multiply by the Cholesky decomposition of that covariance matrix. This is basically the same thing, except instead of multiplying by a single matrix, the G function is more complicated. In the examples I'll show you today, the G function is always represented by a deep convolutional neural network. After you've transformed this random noise Z to an output that's meant to be real data, we now have one of these examples of a fake image that we can feed to the discriminator net. So remember earlier, the discriminator net is trying to classify the data correctly. When it sees real images, it wants to say they're real. When it sees fake images, it wants to say they're fake. And now we're trying to train the generator network. This is where the fact that we're in a game rather than an optimization problem becomes relevant, because we actually train the generator network to compete directly with the discriminator. The generator wants to actually make the discriminator get the wrong answer and output a value near one rather than zero. The reason that this framework works well is that we can train the whole thing with backpropagation. We can take the output of the discriminator and differentiate with respect to the parameters of the generator, using exactly the same algorithm that we'd use to differentiate the output of the discriminator with respect to the parameters of the discriminator. We can basically just think of this as one giant neural network. And when we take gradient steps, we happen to move downhill on the gradient over here and uphill on the gradient over here. So the generator tries to fool the discriminator. We can actually analyze this system using the language of game theory and find an equilibrium point where the gradient goes away for both players. It turns out that under some assumptions, there's only one equilibrium point, and that's the point where the generator has learned the distribution that is creating the training data. At that point, the discriminator is not able to tell what's real and what's fake, and it just outputs a probability of 1/2 for every input, because every input is equally likely to have come from the generator as it is to have come from the discriminator. After we first published this model in 2014, it rapidly improved over the next few years using contributions from many people and also using more and more powerful computational hardware. This slide is slightly out of date because there's actually more progress in 2018 now that just came out recently for the iClear conference in October. But you can see that we've moved quickly from low resolution, low quality grayscale faces to high resolution, actually higher resolution than I can fit in this slide, photorealistic faces. Something that was actually more difficult than faces was generating examples from the ImageNet dataset. ImageNet contains 1,000 different classes. It turns out that even though faces are full of details and it's difficult to make a face photorealistic, it turns out that generating only faces was not nearly as hard as generating just very many different kinds of objects. So it took a little bit longer before we were able to do this at all. The original paper on GANs came out in 2014. The first time we really got even recognizable examples from different ImageNet categories was in 2016. And then over the next few years, we got better and better examples to the point that we're now more or less getting photorealistic examples of all 1,000 ImageNet classes most of the time. Once again, there's actually a new paper that I haven't got incorporated in these slides that is able to make 512 pixel by 512 pixel photorealistic images on ImageNet. That's actually maybe worth tabbing over to a browser and pulling up. So I wasn't able to connect my own laptop to the network or the projector here, so I'm showing you slightly out-of-date slides, but by using the web browser, we can see more recent slides. These are some of the latest images generated by a very large GAN trained on Google's TPUs at DeepMind this fall. So that's where we are for image generation now. You might be wondering, what's the use of being able to generate this stuff? If we already have a training set full of millions of pretty pictures, why do we need more pretty pictures? It turns out that there's a lot of different things that you can do with this kind of a model. One that came up today at Perimeter is actually, what if you want to make a generative model of something you don't get to observe directly? What if you can generate the unobserved thing that you want to see and then transform it to something observable? And that's the thing that you can tell if it's real or fake. GANs allow you to learn that kind of indirectly observable thing. So to make that a tangible example, suppose that you wanted to generate a 3D model of a house, but you only have photos. You could train a differentiable architecture that makes the 3D model and then renders it down to a photo and train it with real photos. So even though you never get to directly observe 3D models of houses, if you can fill in that last rendering step, this differentiable architecture lets you recover the 3D house model. Some examples that have come up other places around the world. One of them is you can actually make training data for other systems. So a lot of people have this idea that you could take a GAN, train it to create images, and then just create a whole lot more images and use them to train a classifier. As far as I know, no one's ever been able to make that work. But what you can do with a GAN is combine different sources of data. So if you have two different kinds of data and each of them doesn't have quite all of the attributes that you want, you can make a GAN that merges those two distributions in some way. So to explain clearly what I mean by that, here's an example that comes from Apple. This is actually the first paper that Apple published after they started publishing machine learning research. Apple wanted to make a model that can take the front-facing camera on your phone and look at your eyes to tell where you're looking on the screen. Someday you might be able to use this kind of technology to click on icons without having to tap on them with your finger. The problem is that to train this kind of a model, we don't actually have the right kind of data to train the eye direction recognition model. We can get lots of photos of users' eyes, like in this top row here, but we don't know where on the screen those eyes are pointed. You can actually use an eye tracking machine, but they apparently don't have the level of accuracy that we'd like. Neuroscientists sometimes use more accurate eye trackers with monkeys where they actually implant metal rings on the monkey's cornea, and you don't usually want to do that with human users to gather this training data. The other kind of data available is synthetic data, where you actually make a 3D model of an eye, and you can render that eye in whatever position you want. So this data, you can actually control where on the virtual screen the eye is looking. And so it's labeled training data that you could use for a supervised machine learning algorithm. You know where this eye is looking. Unfortunately, it's not very realistic, and it's not very representative of what real eyes look like. That's where the generative model comes in. You can actually train a model on photos of real eyes, so it knows what real eyes look like, and then use it to enhance the synthetic images so that at the end of the day, you get an image that is both realistic and has a known eye direction, so it can be used to train the supervised model. Another thing that's pretty exciting about generative models and GANs in particular is that you can use them to convert between two types of data without needing to have supervised pairs. So the example here is actually converting between day images and night images. Is this large enough on the screen? Yeah, I think you can see basically what's going on here. So this is a little bit of lower resolution than some of the other examples. The input on the left is images of driving on the road in the daytime, and these are real photos in a real video. The video on the right is driving on the same road at nighttime, and this is synthetic. This is produced by the generative model, converting the video on the left to the video on the right one frame at a time. The reason that a GAN is exciting here is that we are actually able to train this without needing to find corresponding pairs of day photos and night photos. You train the model to take a day image and convert it into another image such that it becomes a realistic night image. So the discriminator in the GAN framework tells you, is this a valid night image, yes or no? It doesn't tell you, is this exactly the night image that corresponds to the day image that we started with? If you wanted to train such a system with supervised learning, it would be very difficult to gather the data that you need. Because think about all the different cars on the road and other configurations that would be hard to replicate. You need to actually find all those cars and get them to drive back to the same position with the same velocity on the road, frame by frame, if you wanted to actually have a supervision signal for this. So that's called unsupervised domain translation. Another really fun example with it is turning horses into zebras. You can imagine there's the same problem, like how would you get the zebra to pose in the same position as the horse for supervised data? But this is a model called CycleGAN that was developed at Berkeley, turning a horse into a zebra alive. One thing that's kind of fun to watch is that this model is actually going one frame at a time, so it's not enforcing coherence. Let's see, the YouTube video looks a little bit compressed. Let me see if we can find a different version of this. So I think the GitHub page has the raw uncompressed version. Oh, they turned Vladimir Putin into a zebra. Okay, here we go. Here's the uncompressed video. So if you watch carefully when the zebra turns his head, the stripes actually remain stationary, and the head moves across the stripes. So that's because this model is actually working one frame at a time and isn't doing anything to make the frames remain coherent with each other. Another thing that's kind of interesting here and that illustrates the issue of bias in machine learning a little bit is that the model doesn't really know that what we care about is the horse and the zebra. It just knows that we care about transforming the one distribution into the other distribution. Horses are usually photographed in like farm environments where the grass tends to be green because it's been artificially watered. And zebras are photographed out in the wild, like in the savanna where the landscape is relatively arid. So we can see we're actually turning the grass into zebra habitat at the same time that we're turning the horse into a zebra. That's the kind of thing to keep in mind when you're developing other kinds of machine learning applications, is whatever data you give it, it's going to learn the patterns that are there. And some of them may not be the patterns that you intended for it to pick up on. So I mentioned that this was generating one frame at a time. There's actually newer work that that generates entire videos in a coherent fashion. Let me skip ahead a little bit to a more interesting part of this talk. So this is actually showing that you can take a 3D rendering of the pose of an artificial figure and then render it as a photorealistic person. That's also using basically the same procedure as before, except now when we train the generative model, it's assessing whether the whole video is real or fake, rather than assessing whether individual frames are real or fake. Let's see, is it possible to get sound on here?
Try now. I think it's turned off in the video.
It's muted in the video? Okay, yeah. So sound wasn't that important for this one, but it is for the next one. So a recent project from Berkeley actually shows how you can make a model that takes video of a person dancing rather than the 3D rendered position and outputs video of another person dancing. So you can actually take like a professional dancer and map it onto a grad student. So that model actually incorporates a lot of different things. It has a GAN as part of the generation pipeline, but it also has a lot of hand-designed aspects, like automatically detecting the pose of the people in the input video. So we're starting to see that these models are useful components of larger hand-designed systems, where you can think of them as a tool that you can build on now, and not just as a research direction in their own right. One thing I'm particularly excited about in terms of applying GANs is actually bringing them into the physical world. There's a company here in Canada called Deep Genomics, and they published a paper about using GANs to design protein sequences where the GAN generates DNA that corresponds to proteins that actually bind to specific receptors. So far, everything they've published is in silico, but in principle, you could use this same approach to make real DNA sequences that work in the real world. So we might actually start to see GANs used for medicine in the not too distant future.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So on something like this, so we have a fair amount of domain knowledge about, say, the physics of the interactions with the protein and what possible configurations are. How do you think someone should try and encode that into a GAN? Do we just give it lots of examples that sort of like, this is a thing that protein, these are like, just show it examples, or should we be coming at this from another angle?
So the question is, how should we encode domain knowledge? And I agree with the one thing you suggested, which is just showing lots of examples. One thing we see like in computer vision is we know that if you shift an image by a few pixels left or right, up or down, you ought to get the same answer. A lot of people have talked about how convolutional neural networks are designed to be invariant to translation. It turns out if you actually test them, they're not really all that invariant to translation. But one way that you can make them become more invariant to translation is to train them on lots of shifted images. So for example, if you knew that two different sequences of amino acids should have the same shape, then you could augment your training set using that information. I don't know a lot about the DNA problem specifically, so I don't know a lot about what people really ought to do there. The paper definitely describes it a lot more than I'm able to tell you. But it is an important question in general, I think, which is, what's the best way to encode our knowledge of the domain into individual models? One thing that's actually, I believe, on the market now already is using GANs to make 3D printed dental crowns. So this is, as far as I know, the first example of a GAN making a macro scale physical object. The reason that this is useful is that to get a traditional dental crown, you need a technician to design a crown specifically for you. The crown replaces a piece of your tooth that was lost, and it has to actually fit with your other teeth. It needs both to be able to actually cut through food when you chew, but it additionally needs to not harm your other teeth when you close your mouth. So it really is a personalized item. In the past, usually people have a temporary crown inserted in one operation, and then about 2 weeks later, after the technician has finished designing their personalized crown, they have a second operation to install the final crown. With the new GAN-based approach, it's possible to scan your teeth, have the GAN generate a crown just for you, and then 3D print it, and have that be the first crown that's installed. So you only need one operation instead of two to install and then swap out the temporary crown. The GANs for images today are largely based on using self-attention. There's a paper from Facebook AI Research called Non-Local Neural Networks. And my group at Google took their idea for how to make non-local neural networks and incorporated that into the GAN framework. Using that, we were able to get images up to this level of photorealism. And then the more recent images I showed you in the web browser a little while ago are basically this algorithm scaled up to run larger on TPUs. The way that the self-attention mechanism works is when you're generating a particular point in the feature map of the convolutional feature map of the generator, it actually gets to look around the image and focus attention on different points in the feature map by giving more weight to those areas. So when drawing the eye of the dog, it can actually place its attention on the other eye, and that helps to do things like make the two eyes symmetrical. Or when drawing the leg, it looks around and sees where the other legs are. Before this attention mechanism, there used to be a lot of trouble with convolutional networks, drawing too many or too few copies of different things, or drawing different body parts in asymmetrical ways. Convolutional networks basically just take one pattern and replicate it all over the whole image. There isn't very much to identify different image locations as being unique in any way. So any individual point within the convolutional net had to just sort of guess whether that piece of the convolutional net was responsible for drawing the leg or not. And a lot of the time, more than one part would guess that it was responsible for doing that. So a lot of the time you'd see dogs with like a big stack of heads or you know, dogs with no legs because like any average part of the image is not the leg. So lots of parts decide that they're just like fur on the torso, but no part is the leg. With the attention mechanism, most of those problems are resolved. We also put the attention mechanism in the discriminator. So the discriminator can do things like look around the image and check that the different parts of it are consistent with each other. So that was the generative modeling research topic. Yeah.
Do you put in the features of interest, like on the training data, or is it?
That is all learned from scratch in the GAN framework. If you wanted to put in features of interest, you could hand design those. And as long as they're differentiable, they would still work with the backprop algorithm. So you could have differentiable features that you hand designed in the discriminator, and they'd backprop into the generator, and the generator would learn how to fool them.
I think I got what the purpose is of the self-attention, but how do you actually implement it?
It's basically, there's different variants of it. But the idea is you have a little feature vector describing each local area, and you have a feature vector describing what kind of things you want to attend to. And then at each location, you take the difference between those feature vectors and you know, take the norm of that diff. And then the actual attention weight that you get for that location is some kind of monotonically increasing function of the negative diff. So like e to the negative norm of diff a lot of the times. So that gives you an actual coefficient telling you how much to care about each particular location. Then to give a vector summarizing the whole image, you add up weighted sums of all the feature vectors from around the image. So the weighting factor is this e to the negative diff that describes how closely each area matches the type of thing you're trying to attend to. There's slightly different versions of all these attention mechanisms, but that's the basic idea. For a long time, people were working what's called hard attention, where you literally ignore some features, some points in space entirely in order to get a computational speed up. As far as I know, no one has gotten that working very well. Most of what we use today is called soft attention. And so there, we're actually still explicitly multiplying by zero or values very near zero across most of the image. So the role of the attention mechanism now is to change the kinds of functions that we can represent. But it isn't really doing anything to reduce the computational cost. In fact, actually, the computational cost is a lot higher. A lot of the work that we had to do to get this generative model here working was design ways to bring the computational cost down a little bit. Han, the first author of this paper, did a lot of experiments to find what was the smallest number of layers he could get away with adding attention to and still get a good effect, because it's a quadratic cost, really. Every pixel that wants to use attention has to look at every other pixel in the image. And so if you're applying attention to a whole feature map, that scales like the number of locations in the feature map squared. So it's a relatively costly thing to do, but it has a very beneficial effect on the quality of the outcome. So another topic that is relevant to adversarial machine learning is actually security. So let's say that we have a model that can train on some training data represented by this capital X, and it produces parameters as a result of the training algorithm, and then we use those parameters to make predictions on new test examples, and the predictions are represented by this y hat variable. So let's say that there are two players in a game. One is the defender, represented by the white chess piece here. The defender gathers the training data, designs the training algorithm, runs the training algorithm to get the parameters, and makes the predictions. And then let's say that there's an attacker. And in this model, the attacker has access to the data at test time and can slightly modify it. So if the attacker can modify the test data, they can also modify the test time predictions. In other words, the attacker might try to fool the machine learning model by presenting unusual inputs. So you might hope that a good secure model would be relatively hard to fool, or that to fool it, you might need to make relatively big changes to the input. It turns out that modern machine learning algorithms are not very secure at all. You can fool them with really trivial changes. Here we start with this image of a panda, and we take this carefully calculated vector in its input space. We scale it down by a lot. We scale it down so it's just barely small enough that it will not change any of the pixels in the 8-bit representation, but it still changes their 32-bit representation. And then we add that scaled perturbation to the image. We get this new image here. On the projector, this image and this image are identical because we left the 8-bit representation unchanged. In the machine learning algorithm, the 32-bit representation has changed, and this is now no longer recognized as a panda. In this case, the model thinks it's a gibbon. On top of that, the confidence level has changed. This was only 70% confident that it was a panda, and this is now 99.9% confident it's a gibbon. So the attacker has not only caused them to get the wrong answer, the model is actually more confident when it's wrong and under attack than when it was correct. You can imagine other kinds of adversarial examples where this is a physical stop sign with graffiti on it. It wouldn't really fool a human, but a machine learning algorithm is now no longer able to recognize this as being a stop sign. Or you can just take pictures in really weird conditions. Like, I found that if you put this apple inside a bag, it's no longer recognized as being an apple. So the attacker doesn't really need to do this kind of exotic pixel-level manipulation. Things that are pretty easy to do in the physical world can fool these systems if you're intentionally trying to fool them. We've also found that if you do those pixel-level manipulations and then just print them out and take photos of them on a smartphone camera, they actually still fool the machine learning algorithm, even though they've gone through all the lighting and viewpoint and lens effect, JPEG encoding transformations. So it's pretty easy to fool machine learning algorithms in a lot of different settings. So far, the best defense that we have against this is actually to treat it as a minimax problem and have two different players play the game at training time. One of these players is the machine learning model itself, which is doing the same thing that it usually does. It tries to minimize its cost on the training data. But there's now a second player who actually corrupts the training data by adding some perturbation eta, and they're trying to maximize the cost paid by the machine learning model. If you look at what this does to the accuracy of a classifier on both clean and adversarial data, we see that if you start with a regular classifier trained only on clean data, it learns according to this blue learning curve, where over time it starts with high error, and then the error rate drops off, and then levels off at some low error rate. If you look at how that same model performs on adversarial data, where the attacker is trying to fool it, we get this green curve at the top. As the regular learning algorithm learns, it never really gets any better at all on the adversarial data. So now let's compare what happens if we learn with an adversarial machine learning approach. If we train on clean and adversarial examples and test on adversarial examples, we find that the error rate on adversarial examples actually goes down over time. How far down it goes depends a lot on which problem you're studying and also on the model you're using and things like that. We are not yet able to get it to go down quite as low as it goes on clean data, but it does get down pretty far. So this makes the model more robust than it would otherwise have been. Another thing that's really exciting is that on some data sets and for some models, we actually find that if you evaluate the robust model on clean data, looking at this red curve here, on some data sets, it actually becomes more accurate than it did on the, more accurate than the non-robust model did. So we've trained it to be secure, but it also became better at just classifying regular data. That turns out not to happen most of the time. In practice, there seems to be a trade-off between security under attack and performance in the non-robust setting. We don't yet know why that is fully. It's possible to construct some artificial examples where there's specific reasons for it happening, but all of those examples are kind of artificial and don't really correspond to real-world tasks like image recognition or speech recognition yet. So we don't have a good understanding of whether we can expect secure machine learning to be better for image recognition or not in the long run. But we know that there's some problems where security does improve accuracy, and we know that there's some problems where the two are in conflict. Another really popular research topic is getting machine learning to work for reinforcement learning. Reinforcement learning is where you don't actually know what the right answer is. The model has to figure out for itself. For example, you can have it play Atari games, and it learns by trying to increase the score that it receives over time. It's possible to make adversarial examples for reinforcement learning algorithms. My colleague Sandy Huang showed how you can make little tiny perturbations to images of Atari games and make the model fail to play Atari. You can also think of quite a lot of reinforcement learning algorithms as examples of adversarial machine learning. In fact, I would say that actually the first machine learning was RL-based adversarial machine learning. Arthur Samuel made an agent that plays checkers back in the 1950s, and it worked by playing games against itself. So you can think of it as a Minimax game played between two copies of the same algorithm. That same principle is still what's used for things like AlphaGo, OpenAI's sumo wrestling agents, and OpenAI's Defense of the Agents 2 agents. All of it really dates back to Arthur Samuel's checkers playing agent. And that settled a really foundational debate in artificial intelligence back in the 50s. For a long time, people believed that a computer could only do what it was programmed to do, and that it could never exceed the abilities of its programmer. Arthur Samuel wasn't particularly great at playing checkers, and he was nonetheless able to make an agent that became really good at checkers by self-play, and it was able to beat him. So that proved that somehow it knew more about checkers than he did, even though he was its programmer. Since then, we've seen that self-play makes it possible for things like AlphaGo to beat the best human players in the world at their respective board games. So this principle of adversarial self-play is definitely really useful for a lot of reinforcement learning applications. Another way that adversarial machine learning can be useful for reinforcement learning is providing better reward functions. A lot of the time when you want your reinforcement learning agent to do something, it can be really hard to write down a reward function that describes exactly what it ought to do. One example of that is suppose you want to make a robot that uses a paintbrush to copy an image of a character. It'd be hard to write a reward function for this because the pixels in this input image are perfectly black and white, and there's no perspective or anything, while the canvas is always going to be viewed at a certain angle, and it's going to have all kinds of lighting effects and so on. You'll never get the pixels of the canvas to exactly match the pixels of the input image. What you can do, though, is train a GAN discriminator to judge how well you're doing at faking the input images using the canvas. And that turns out to provide a reward signal that's more useful for guiding the real robot to imitate the kind of schematic input. So this project called Synthesizing Programs for Images Using Reinforced Adversarial Learning actually was able to make this robot copy characters from omniglot.com, which is a database of symbols in lots of different languages from around the world. Another important research topic is making machine learning extremely reliable. A lot of the time, our machine learning algorithms are pretty good at tasks that software just couldn't tackle before, like recognizing images. traditional software was just hopeless for it. And now we're able to get accuracies in the upper 90% using machine learning. However, there are a lot of applications where upper 90% is just not good enough. If you want to have a self-driving car that doesn't crash, or you want to have an air traffic control system, or you want to have a robot that does surgery on people, you don't want those things to have 97% accuracy. You want them to be essentially perfect. So adversarial machine learning is actually a good way of researching this problem of how to make things just super, super robust. The basic idea is that if you can build a system that is successful when there is an adversary trying to interfere with it, it's much more likely to be successful when just random things are going wrong. This is actually the way that people built robust distributed systems for computation, like we use for huge file systems at Google. If you study things like Byzantine fault tolerance, these were all based on how do you get lots of computers on a network to agree on things when you know, packets are getting lost on the network and machines are crashing. In the Byzantine fault tolerance literature, people assume that a malicious attacker is actually controlling some of the machines and having them send false messages over the network or maliciously fail to send messages. If you can then design protocols that result in correct processing of data, even when there's an adversary controlling some of the machines, it turns out those are really robust in the real world under natural crashing conditions. We're starting to see a little bit of this for machine learning. The idea of studying what happens when a machine learning system receives adversarial inputs led to the creation of a system called ReluPlex. ReluPlex can analyze a ReLU network and certify that it is robust to certain categories of adversarial examples. And then that has actually been feasible to use to certify air traffic control systems and show that under certain descriptions of their state that they'll never make planes collide. Another really important research topic is label efficiency. Right now, deep learning works really well for a lot of applications, but it's often extremely label hungry. Like for example, ImageNet takes 1.2 million images. Or one thing that I did at Google was I made a system for reading address numbers out of photos so that you can add buildings to maps using Street View cars. Using that, we were able to add buildings to maps in countries that didn't really have any digital maps before. So it's now possible to get turn-by-turn directions in countries like Brazil. The thing that was disappointing about that system, though, is I'm not even allowed to publish the number of images that it was trained on. I'm allowed to say it was more than 10 million. When each of us learned to read, we did not need 10 million plus images to learn to do that. So how can we get machine learning to learn like a human child rather than learn by traveling around the world and seeing every house number in existence? So one approach to what's called semi-supervised learning is to make a GAN that can actually learn from labeled examples as well as just learning from unlabeled ones. Previously, we showed how you can have a GAN discriminator that tells whether things are real or fake. And now we're going to extend it to actually say which categories the real things belong to. So if we want to train a cat versus dog classifier, we can train it to say whether an input is a real cat, a real dog, or a fake image of a cat or a dog. And the reason this is called semi-supervised learning is that it can learn from both supervised examples, where you have an input and you say, this is a cat or this is a dog. But it can also learn from unlabeled examples, where you just say, here's a photo of something. I'm not telling you whether it's a cat or a dog. The system can now learn from three different types of data. It can learn from real labeled data, real unlabeled data, in which case it just tries to maximize the sum over all the probabilities of all the real classes. Or it can also learn from fake data coming from the generator and learn to reject it as fake. So all three sources of these data can be used to exercise the network as a whole. And it turns out to be able to successfully learn with very little real labeled data. In particular, at OpenAI, we were able to get this kind of model to learn to recognize handwritten digits with over 99% accuracy using only 100 labeled examples. Just a few years earlier, it took about 60,000 labeled examples to get to that level of accuracy. Another way that adversarial machine learning can be useful for learning from unlabeled examples and reducing the number of labels you need is called virtual adversarial training. This was invented by Takeru Miyato. He works at Preferred Networks now. And the basic idea is that if you have an unlabeled example, you don't know what label it ought to have, but you might know a lot of equivalence classes, where if you modify the image in some way, the labels should not change. So if you make those adversarial perturbations, like where I turned the panda into the gibbon earlier, we would like the model to still keep the same label as it had before. So you might start with an unlabeled image of a panda and ask the model to guess what it is. If it's in training for a while already, it might guess that it's a panda with low confidence. Then you bring in the adversary, and the adversary changes the image in order to deviate from that original guess. So maybe now it thinks it's a gibbon. Then you train it to say, actually, these two images should come from the same class. You don't know what class it is, but you're trying to enforce this constraint that these little tiny changes don't alter the output. If we compare a bunch of different approaches to semi-supervised learning, my team at Google recently found that virtual adversarial training is the best algorithm out of the ones that they benchmarked. So with 250 labeled examples, reading photos of address numbers, it gets about 7% error, while all the other approaches get significantly more error, well above 10% error. As you add more and more labeled examples, we eventually find that all the different algorithms converge. So when you have lots of labeled data, you may as well just use supervised learning. But when you have very little labeled data, virtual adversarial training is a good way to make your algorithm continue to perform well. Another topic where you might face an adversary in machine learning is privacy. Here, the idea is that the defender gathers some training data. And this might be very sensitive training data, like medical records. And they use it to learn some parameters that they would then like to publish to the general public. This means that an attacker represented by the black chess piece might be able to observe these parameters and infer what the training data contained. So they could actually recover sensitive medical records. It turns out that you can defend against this using a framework called differential privacy. The word differential here does not refer to derivatives. It refers to the difference between two hypothetical data sets. So suppose you have one data set containing this person and another data set that does not contain this person. If you can prove that your training algorithm produces statistically indistinguishable results, regardless of which of the two data sets you train on, then it has not sacrificed the privacy of this individual person. In other words, everything that it learned is a general pattern rather than a quirk of an individual record that it has memorized. I'll skip a little bit over exactly how you can implement that, but there's a variety of ways you can implement algorithms with that property. Another thing I think might be particularly interesting to the parameter audience is what's called domain adaptation. The idea of domain adaptation is that you have a model that you'd like to do the same thing in many different domains. So for example, for image recognition, we often have data sets that were collected with different cameras or in different locations, and they have slightly different statistics. What we'd like to do is make models that pull out features where the features are indistinguishable statistically across all the different domains. This means that rather than fitting the quirks of an individual domain, they've learned general properties of the task they're trying to solve. So in this case, we want to detect pedestrians, and we don't want the network to over-specialize to one of the particular cities or cameras that are used for each of these different data sets. The reason I think this is particularly interesting here at Perimeter is that this same principle is also applied to removing nuisance variables from scientific experiments. There's a paper called Learning to Pivot. I don't remember the full author list. Kyle Cranmer is one of the co-authors. The basic idea is that you have two different models, one that tries to solve the task that you're interested in, and another one that examines the features used by that model and tries to recover the nuisance variables. If you train the first model to do the task while interfering with the second model's ability to recover the nuisance parameters, the model learns to ignore the nuisance parameters entirely. So some people here today were telling me about a problem where they were training a model on data produced by a Monte Carlo algorithm, and the model was learning to pay attention to artifacts that came out of the Monte Carlo system. I think that this domain adversarial approach could be used to train the model to ignore the artifacts in the Monte Carlo system. We've also used it at Google to generalize from the domain of synthetic objects that a robot in a simulator can pick up and the real world domain where the robot wants to pick up real objects. Adversarial machine learning can also be used for fairness. Now that we're starting to use machine learning for more and more important topics that affect people's lives, we'd like to make sure that machine learning algorithms don't copy human biases and discriminate against certain groups of people. So if you have a variable describing like which group a person is in, you would like to make sure that the predictions coming from the model don't depend on that group. It turns out that just leaving that variable out of the model is not enough to protect against it. So like a really simple one is gender. Imagine you just don't tell the machine learning model a person's gender. It's pretty easy to infer their gender. Like if you get to see their name, you can probably infer their gender from their name. If they went to a particular school that serves only one sex, you can infer their gender from the school they went to. So the adversarial approach learns a feature representation that represents inputs in an abstract vector space. You have two different models. One wants to be good at the prediction task. The other one wants to examine the vector representation and try to recover the sensitive variables that you don't want to be involved in the prediction. And so in this adversarial game, the first model learns how to do its task without the allowing the second model to recover the sensitive variable. Adversarial machine learning, I think, will become more and more useful for understanding how machine learning models work internally. That's useful for accountability and transparency. A lot of the literature on interpretability of neural nets builds these tools that says, hey, look at this picture of the cat and the dog. It said that these pixels are cat and these pixels are dog, and they make it look like the machine learning model actually works and is getting the right answer for the right reason. In the adversarial machine learning literature, we've usually seen that it's really easy to fool machine learning models with irrelevant transformations. So I believe that most of the time they get the right answer, they're actually doing it for the wrong reason. I think we need to get these two camps talking to each other a bit more, and we'll hopefully build interpretability tools that can diagnose the wrong beliefs that the models have internally. We've also seen that more robust models are more interpretable. This here shows a standard linear model that recognizes handwriting. We start with an image of a 9, and we use gradient ascent on different class probabilities to turn it into a 0, a 1, a 2, a 3, and so on, all the way back to turning it into a 9. For all of these cases, we got weird adversarial stuff that doesn't actually look like the correct digit. Over here, we have an adversarial robust model where we, again, use gradient ascent on each of the classes to turn it from a 9 to a 0, a 1, a 2, a 3, and so on. And in this case, gradient ascent actually corresponded to human intuition, and we get human recognizable examples of each digit. So I believe over time, as we get more adversarial robust models, we'll actually get more interpretable models. The very last topic I'll mention is I think that machine learning will help us to understand neuroscience. In particular, if we can find adversarial examples that fool both humans and computer vision, it can help us to reverse engineer how the human visual system works. You could imagine using this for other aspects of the human brain as well. Here we have an image of a cat, and we have an adversarial example that is designed to make humans think it's a dog. In vector space, we have made a very small change between these two images. And to me, this one looks very much like a German Shepherd. It's a huge philosophical problem about whether the vector space change is actually small enough that we shouldn't expect the class to change or not. So there's a big debate about whether we're fooling your brain into thinking this is a German Shepherd, or whether we actually just erased this photo and replaced it with a photo of a German Shepherd. But it is definitely an interesting topic to look at the way that the human brain and machine learning algorithms respond to images like this. And I think over time, we might be able to learn more about the specific functional mechanisms used in the brain. One thing we found right now is that the way that the human brain responds to images like this is very different on short time scales than it is on long time scales. That suggests that the feedback recurrent connections in the human brain might be important for the human brain's resistance to adversarial examples. And over time, as we do more of these studies, I think we'll learn more information than that. So I think we're all out of time. Do we have any time for questions or?
Yeah, lots of time for questions.
Lots of time for questions? Okay.
All right.
So we have a tradition of actually starting with questions from the students. So let me open it up, first of all, to student questions. Yeah, in the front row.
So I got a question about the two slides with the digits. Right. So how do you measure robustness here? And then I might have a follow-up question. But yeah.
Yeah, so this was made back in 2015. Robustness was measured in terms of accuracy on the fast gradient sine method attack with epsilon of 0.3. So for those of you who don't follow the adversarial example literature, it means the pixels range in value from 0 for black to 1 for white. And the adversary was allowed to change the brightness by up to 0.3, so about 30% of the dynamic range of the image. And the fast gradient sine method means that they only get to make like one jump in order to fool it.
Okay. So essentially, the difference between these two is
time to stand up.
It's my cron job.
So the difference between these two panels is that this is a more vulnerable model. So it means that as a human, we do not perceive the difference. For us, it's all a 9, but the model will recognize the second 9, like the second yellow box 9.
Yeah,
it's a 1 already, right?
Yeah, every yellow box is where we've hit another target class.
While the one on the rest on the right side is the model, which is kind of more comparable to human vision, because we can see that there is a 0 shaping up, and so we can understand that the model was full.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, the model on the left is a linear model. It's just softmax regression. And it turns out that it's very easy to fool. If you move in the direction of the weight vector for a class, it will think that the output belongs to that class. You don't need to move very far. You just need to make a move that's highly aligned with the weights. And then in high dimensional spaces, the dot product between those two vectors matters a lot more than the magnitude of the vector that you applied. And then the model on the right is a radial basis function model. So it's like a template matcher network. And it turns out to be a lot more robust to adversarial examples in our tests.
One last question, Jeremy. What I'm wondering about is, essentially, we need an open category, so to say, right? That is neither, allows the network to, the classifier to output something that says it's neither 0 nor 1, like none of the digits. Have people tried implementing this, and why did it fail?
Yeah, I think that's a promising direction. People have tried it. The thing that's difficult about it is that it's easy for the adversary to fool the model into thinking that things are not the, people call it the garbage class. Mm-hmm. It's easy for the attacker to fool the model into thinking things are not the garbage class.
Okay.
So you can do adversarial training where you actually use an optimizer to make garbage class examples during the training process, but it still ends up with about the same error rate as you have with regular adversarial training. It's like if you have n real classes and you still force it to say everything is one of those n classes, and you do adversarial training where you have the adversary try to make hard examples for that problem, you'll end up with some error rate that it's hard to get below. Like on the CIFAR-10 data set, we're stuck at about 50% accuracy right now. If you bring in a garbage class, the attacker will still fool people into thinking it's not the garbage class about 50% of the time.
Yeah, it seems that feedforward neural networks are really highly sensitive to input noise. And we know that, human vision isn't, at least not as, or more robust than a lot of feedforward neural nets. And we know that, if you try to track how information is fed forward in the brain, there's dynamics, there's effective dropout, ion channels get blocked and so on. So effectively, maybe the inference should be probabilistic, and people probably have tried this, I imagine, but adding a lot of noise to the inference process. So in a sense, the input noise that's getting perfectly transmitted for, perfect feedforward networks that's creating this artifact would get just washed out, with noise in the feedforward process. So people tried probabilistic feedforward networks, and has that been successful?
Yeah, probably the second most successful approach after adversarial training is dropout at test time, where when you're usually for dropout, you drop units during training so that the model learns to be robust to random missing values. Dropout at test time, when you actually classify, you drop units randomly while you're doing it. The idea there is that the attacker will have a hard time anticipating exactly what you're going to do. It turns out that you can circumvent that by, on the attack side, you simulate the network with, say, 10 different dropout patterns, and you optimize for an input that fools all 10 of those dropout patterns, and then you deploy that one, and with very high probability, whichever new dropout pattern the defender uses at test time, it'll still be fooled.
Is this dropping out a neuron, or is it Gaussian noise so the weights kind of drop out? Or
so I think it's just binary dropout is the one that's been evaluated the most. There's a paper called Adversarial Examples Are Not Easily Detected, where they go through 10 different proposed defense schemes and show that none of them really work. But one of the ones they evaluated is this binary dropout at test time. And that one they said, well, it does sort of work, just not all that much. It worked on the MNIST data set, but then it didn't work very well in the CIFAR-10 data set. if I remember right, on the CIFAR-10 data set, it meant that the attacker had to use slightly larger perturbations to fool the model, but they were still small enough that a human wouldn't really notice them.
Interesting, thanks.
I have a question about error. So typically when people talk, you know, they show the supervised machine learning, they say we have some data X and we want to map it to Y. With physical measurement in the laboratory, you remember probably like at one point someone forced you to estimate your error bars, right? So you take your meter stick and you have to say this is right plus or minus, I don't know, whatever, a centimeter. How do I incorporate my knowledge of error, which comes from whatever experimental apparatus I have, into the actual training? And also, I'm not clear how to get an error estimate out of some of these things.
Yeah. So let's start with getting an error estimate out. And then once I've described that, it'll be easier to describe how you get that error estimate to be right. So a lot of these models give you some kind of representation of a probability distribution. Like a classifier will give you a softmax distribution over the different classes. And then if you have something like a regression model, maybe it outputs the mean and the variance parameter of a Gaussian. So those have the right type signature to describe an error bar. The error bar they describe is usually wildly over-optimistic, though. The way that we train most of these things is with maximum likelihood. So we show them the training data, and we ask them to increase the probability of the training data. And they never really have an incentive to assign a probability less than 1 to the target. So if they're capable of memorizing the training set perfectly, they will memorize the training set perfectly and just assign crazy probabilities to it. So what can you do about that? Well, there's a lot of regularization techniques that will bring the confidence down. You don't really know that they've brought it down the right amount. Another thing you can do is if you have really explicit estimates of what the error in the original measurement was, then you can artificially modify the targets during the training process to move them around within that range. So like if you've measured a value of 1, but you think that it's actually like Gaussian with a mean of 1 and standard deviation of 0.1, you just sample from that Gaussian and use that as the targets during training. So if you present those targets multiple times with the same input, the model should learn a standard deviation parameter of 1 for a Gaussian regression model. For classification, you can randomly sample wrong class labels. And you do that more often as you believe that you have more labeling noise. You can also do some of this synthetically, like you don't need to explicitly sample. For example, if you think that you have a Gaussian distribution of errors and your model outputs a Gaussian distribution, your loss can just be the cross entropy between those two Gaussians instead of a mean squared error of a point value. And then similarly for softmax, you can calculate the cross entropy between some target distribution and the actual softmax distribution output by your model. The last one where you do the cross entropy on the softmax is called label smoothing. And a lot of the time people do it with really smooth distributions, like far more smooth than labeling error would actually explain. It seems to be a pretty good regularizer in general, and it's not 100% understood why. But a lot of the time you might pretend that you have like 10% label noise, even if your real label noise is probably nowhere near that. And it often just actually makes the model more accurate in general.
Let me open it up to questions in general.
So when we're, if I were teaching, if I wanted to teach a person adversarially to do something, I wouldn't normally just make them do the thing and then tell them it was wrong, right? I wouldn't try as hard as I can to beat them every time. I would instead dumb myself down a little and tell them that's very good, but give them a little more detailed feedback than just this is bad. And in practice, one tends to find, I think, with at least in the 2016 paper, read, that a common failure mode is the discriminator gets too strong and just always defeats the generator, which no longer has any credence. Is there any way to has there any work been done on making a discriminator act more like a tutor than like an adversary?
So I'm not totally sure that it's really a problem for the discriminator to be too smart. I'm not completely decided on that, but I'm not sure that you need to take the existing algorithm and necessarily think of it as adversarial. Part of the reason we came up with that name was that the way we ended up proving that the algorithm should work was using game theory. And in that paradigm, you're kind of thinking of the players as adversaries. So one metaphor I use for describing GANs is that you have police and counterfeiters, and the counterfeiters are trying to make better and better money. That metaphor doesn't 100% make sense because the police are sort of giving too much information to the counterfeiters. Like, the police wouldn't normally give a gradient back to the counterfeiters. So it's a little bit like there's a mole in the police station or something. Another metaphor I use to think of GANs sometimes is, imagine that you've got like an astronaut with a jetpack, and the astronaut is trying to fly to some specific location. And then ground control can like ping the astronaut with radar and get an estimate of how far away they are. But it's kind of a laggy estimate. And then over the radio, they say, like, you need to fly up, you need to fly down, you need to fly left, fly right, whatever. So that's a cooperative situation. And, you know, we haven't chosen to model it with game theory, but it describes the same kind of algorithm. So for GANs, you can think of what the discriminator is doing is it's trying to estimate a ratio between the true data density and the sum of the true data density and the model density. So if you get this ratio correct, then the derivatives through the discriminator tell the generator the correct update. From that point of view of you want to get the ratio correct, I don't really see a reason to limit the intelligence of the discriminator. Like if they get the ratio wrong, you'll get the wrong learning signal. And if they get the ratio right, you'll get exactly the maximum likelihood learning signal. The thing that gets tricky is that for some distributions, the maximum likelihood criterion and its gradient might not even be defined. So this comes up a lot if the model doesn't have support everywhere. So the example that's really famous from the Wasserstein-GAN paper is, what if your model is the distribution of like points in a line, and it's parallel to the line where the real data lies? Then the probability the model assigns to the real data is zero, and so the log probability is, in machine learning land, we would say undefined. And you can't learn anything from it. So that's one reason that you could imagine wanting to smooth the discriminator a little bit, is if the actual maximum likelihood criterion you're trying to estimate wouldn't be defined if the discriminator became perfect. I think it has less to do with the game dynamics than to do with the fact that maximum likelihood can't handle some kinds of estimation problems. And then I guess the other thing that's going on here is you can actually change your loss function around a little bit and get loss functions that learn better. So in the original GAN paper, we described two different loss functions. One is where you literally play a minimax game, and the generator gets negative the discriminator's cost. What's going on there is the discriminator's cost is a cross entropy. And so if we visualize it in one dimension, it looks a little bit like a hockey stick. So the nice thing about a cross entropy is that if your model has the wrong answer, you're always on the steep part of the hockey stick. And if your model has the right answer, you're on the flat part of the hockey stick, but you're already at minimum loss, so it doesn't matter that you have no gradient. I think this is a lot of why classifiers work so much better today than they did in the 90s. In the 90s, people used to do things like take a softmax probability distribution and try to match it to the target with mean squared error. The gradients of that can vanish even when you don't have the right answer yet. Today, we always use cross entropies. And the cross entropy is only going to have the gradient vanish if you've already got the right answer. So in the GAN framework, the discriminator, if you train it as a sigmoid probability discriminator, the discriminator will always have gradient until it has the right answer already, and then it won't have gradient anymore. If you use the negative of the discriminator's cost for the generator won't have gradient anymore either if the discriminator gets too smart. So what you can do instead is, rather than flipping the sign of the cost function, you flip the labels for the cross entropy for the generator. And so now the generator is saying, I'm trying to minimize the cross entropy between the discriminator's prediction and the incorrect label. So now it's got a hockey stick that's flipped around like this, and it has gradient whenever the discriminator is getting the right answer, and it pushes back to where it's getting the wrong answer. And then at that point, the discriminator is on this hockey stick. And so if you use this flipping the labels approach to the game, they basically always have gradient. I did throw the word basically in there. So there can still be a problem that this is all looking at what is the gradient of the cost function with respect to the output of the discriminator. The discriminator can still saturate on the inside. So like if it's a ReLU net and all the ReLUs turn off, then you're in trouble. And I don't have a great answer to that. But I'm also not sure that I'm not sure that you end up with all the ReLUs saturating more often if your discriminator is powerful. In fact, my guess would be that a big discriminator is less likely to have everything shut down. The main time I've seen a lot of trouble with the internal gradients going to zero is if you have batch norm and you allow it to batch normalize on separately on the real data and the fake data. And then it can just measure the standard deviation of the two distributions perfectly. And if there's any discrepancy in the standard deviation, it becomes really confident which one is which. So that was kind of a long, rambly answer, but the high-level bit is you should do the label flipping trick. And for the most part, I think you should try to make the discriminator as smart as possible.
I can inject a question
here. Yeah.
A bit less specific, but it's about whether machine learning in general can teach us anything about what a good scientific theory is. So, you know, physicists and philosophers have long argued about what that means, and a lot of the kind of proposed definitions seem to map on to certain kinds of machine learning ideas. So, you know, if my theory can predict something based on, you know, some of the existing data while withholding, you know, I built my theory while some of the data was withheld, and then my theory predicts the rest of the data, even though that prediction is not about the future, I can still say, well, that's a success of my theory. But obviously, if it, you know, predicts some novel experimental phenomena, that's also the credit of my theory. So I'm just wondering, does all these new ideas maybe translate into better ideas for sort of how we should evaluate scientific theories and their success?
Yeah. That's maybe more high level and philosophical than I'm prepared to give you an excellent answer on, but I can give you a low quality answer sampled from my generative model. So one thing I'd say we could learn from this is that a theory doesn't need to be completely true and correct to be useful. It needs to make correct predictions in the context where you're going to use it. So one thing we can see from adversarial machine learning is on a lot of inputs, our models have completely the wrong theory. Like this is a panda, but it thinks it's a given with essentially 100% confidence. Nonetheless, we're still able to make all kinds of useful photo album apps using this model. The way that you see the difference is, where do you actually test this theory? Do you test it on IID data that resembles the training data? Or do you test it on adversarially selected data? So to make a good scientific theory that you know is true, you really need to red team it. You really need to test it on adversarial data, because a naive benchmark, like the ImageNet test set, might convince you that you have a great theory when you actually have a completely broken theory. On the other hand, if you know exactly the context in which you need to use the theory, you may not need to make it be perfectly true and correct to actually get useful mileage out of it. And I think
adversarial data for a physics theory.
I'll go really risky here and talk about physics. It'll be obvious I don't know what I'm talking about. But so let's say that your physics theory is like Newtonian mechanics. That probably works okay if you're building like a steam engine or something. So that's an example of how an incorrect theory can be useful. But then you start finding unusual conditions that stress the theory, like objects moving near the speed of light. And now you find that Newtonian mechanics doesn't help you build GPS systems where you're communicating with satellites using light. So that's both an example of how when you change the situation where you're trying to use the theory, your requirements for how accurate it has to be become greater before it's useful. It's also an example of how adversarial data exposes the flaws in the earlier theory that isn't as accurate. I guess another thing I'd say is like testability is really super important. Like a lot of machine learning has been hill climbing, because when we take a machine learning model, we can measure how good it is pretty accurately, and we can just rank a bunch of them on a lot of benchmarks, and over time the benchmark numbers keep getting better and better. So a lot of people complain that some of that progress is illusory, but a lot of that progress has also been real. And we were able to do things now just by hill climbing that we weren't able to do at all 10 years ago.
Let me make a suggestion. We'll have a couple more questions and then we'll move the question period downstairs. Let me take the first two questions I saw.
Thinking ahead, generative neural networks are able to generate shapes, just like images and other configurational things. How long would you say would it take until you use generative neural networks to generate architectures for neural networks? So basically one level higher. At the moment, we seem to, by hand, say, okay, we want this to be adversarial in this way or that way, but maybe that configuration, that what is still done manually, could that be optimized in this way? What do you suspect that eventually the no-free lunch there would prevent us from going arbitrarily far?
There are already people that use reinforcement learning to generate the neural network structures. They have an LSTM that prints out like characters in a language describing the architecture, and then the reward function is the accuracy of the resulting architecture on the validation set. You can think of that as a kind of generative model that's trained by reinforcement learning. So I guess the answer is people have already been doing that for a year and a half or 2 years or so, maybe. And then the other question is it worth it? It uses a lot more computation to do that. And in some cases, it ends up performing slightly better than the human-designed architecture. In some cases, I think it hasn't quite matched the human level of accuracy of the final architecture yet. But I think the place it'll be really worth it is when people start tackling lots of different machine learning problems. Today, everyone is really focused on a small number of benchmarks that everyone competes on. And so, of course, it's hard to compete with human performance there. It's, you know, the performance of thousands of people over tens of years. But when we start using machine learning in areas where maybe you're the first person to use machine learning on that type of problem, then I think AutoML can help you a lot there.
Yeah, final question.
So I'm interested in ways of forcing the ensemble properties of your generated data. So let's say you want to generate pictures of dogs, but you want the average color of the dog to have some smooth distribution between black and white. So you want exponentially more black dogs than white dogs, but you want it to force that to happen in a smooth way. Do you have suggestions for that?
So you're saying, like, over time, you want the model to change what it's doing, or?
Yeah, I want, if I generate 1,000 images, let's say, using my random initial data, you just say a Gaussian random noise or something, that it will have the right exponential distribution, and if I use 10,000, I'll have the same exponential distribution, so that you essentially generate over time images with the right ensemble properties.
Yeah. Do you have a way of measuring the blackness of the dogs?
Yeah.
Okay. So one thing you could do is you could train a generative model that just generates all dogs, and then you could start sampling from restricted regions of its latent space. So you could fit a Gaussian distribution that has the mostly black distribution of our dogs that you like, and then fit a Gaussian distribution that has the mostly white distribution of our dogs that you like, and then just smoothly interpolate between those two distributions. So when you sample from the Gaussian and latent space and then decode it, you'll get mostly white dogs if you're near the parameters for the white dog distribution Gaussian, and you'll get mostly black dogs if you sample from the Z space for the mostly black dog distribution.
Yeah, okay, so you suggest like post-sampling on the latent space rather than trying to force it to, say, be, you know, force part of your latent space to be exponentially distributed or appropriately distributed to what the output you want is.
It's hard to do that, yeah. Maybe eventually we'll be able to do that. I don't know of an algorithm that I can recommend as, you know, just use this algorithm to regularize that part of your space to do what you want and it'll automatically do it. You could look into adversarial autoencoders. They do let you shape your latent space quite a bit, but I'm not sure that they're quite at the point that you'd want yet.
All right, well, we have a chance for more questions downstairs in the Beast Room for snacks, but let's thank Ian again.